average game for you.
Hello and welcome, everybody, to another Star Ledger podcast alongside Connor Orr. I'm Mike Vorkunov. We're back. It's been a while. We're sorry. I know you missed us. But we got a lot to talk about in this one. We're 2 days away. This is Wednesday, 25th. We're taping this. 2 days away from the start of the Olympics, start of the opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
Paul McCartney singing Hey Jude.
Not only that, we are about a week away from the trade deadline in Major League Baseball.
And not only in your video game season.
And not only in my MLB 12, the show season. And we are kind of...
all these training camps start at different times.
Yeah, the NFL training camps coming up. And we are also kind of on the heels of one of the most gigantic NCAA penalties ever handed down to a university. So, I mean...
And a controversial one at that. Not just the penalty itself, but its place.
So, a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, so let's start off somewhere everyone wants to start off on. Baseball. No, wait, that's not it. Let's start something else. How about Olympics? How about that?
That's good.
Okay, that should be a good place to start. I figure that's the most important thing on the docket with it being worldwide and everything. I know our listeners in the Far East, in my homeland of Russia, are listening.
Yeah.
Scranton, your hometown.
My homeland of Scranton.
Our reach goes over there. So this has got you know, a big web. Olympics start this Friday. They're going to be in London, if you haven't heard. They have a wacky logo. It's like an L and an O and 12, and it's all weird. And then the
mascot, too, is like, it looks like a Pixar cartoon, kind of. I don't know, I think
it's
okay.
If you go to Steve Politi's Twitter account, at Steve Politi, he's got a photo with it. Don't really know how to describe it. It looks like a weird Gumby type thing.
Yeah, kind of like a silver Gumby with only one eye instead of two.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I'm not a big fan of the whole Cyclops thing. I hope that's not discriminatory.
That's fine.
Okay. And I tell you what, this is like really one of the most interesting Olympics in recent memory. And you ask, how can you grasp that? Because what do you know about the Olympics? Well, I say a lot. There's a lot of good storylines in every of the major events, in swimming, in track, in basketball. You know, there's a lot to look out for. And I figure the best thing about all that is how star-studded all those events are, but how there's really no clear winner for the sprints in track, or for the big swimming events with Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps, or even who the basketball champ is going to be between the U.S. and Spain.
And I think one of the things that everybody, give kudos to the people who do public relations, for each of these individual sports for the Olympics, and really creating, you know, a buzz going into the games. I mean, I feel like we know these people better than we have before, you know, and I feel like we know a lot of people in respective sports. And, you know, in swimming you talked about, you know, that rivalry between Phelps and Lochte was pushed really, really hard. And, you know, even you go as far as something like freestyle wrestling, you know, the U.S. made a huge push to create a face of wrestling in New Jersey's Jordan Burroughs. You know, stuff that they can market, stuff that they can stick out to people, you know, just so it's in the back of our head, stuff that we can look out for. So I think that they've done a better job of that than they ever have before. I feel like I know more about the Olympics going in than I ever have before.
Yeah, and I guess instead of jumping around, let's kind of get going here. We'll start off with swimming. Obviously, Lochte and Phelps are the two big names, mm-hmm. two big rivals. They're like the Dave and Dan of these Olympics, except they both qualified for the Olympics.
Dave and Dan?
You remember the Reebok advertising campaign?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then one of them didn't make it.
You're a year older than me, so.
Yeah, but I've got a lot more wisdom.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Years.
That's more. Yeah.
Yeah. You're kind of our go-to swimming guy here. I mean, how big is this Lochte-Phelps duel going to be in London several times?
It's going to be great, and I think it's going to be great because this is Phelps' last Olympics, and, you know, there are some gold medal records in his sights, things that he, you know, and he probably will get the record. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that, but at the same time, you know, I think that it's really interesting. There was probably a lot of kind of tension. I mean, you know, it seemed like this team really got along with each other. I mean, when they first exploded and, you know, we really saw them swim so well together at Beijing, everyone was like, you know, talking about how together they were, how cool everything was. But really, I mean, you know, there's probably like a little bit of underlying, you know, jealousy, some tension. And I think that's come out, you know. Lockie has kind of talked about Phelps a little bit. Phelps talked about Lockie a little bit. And I think in Lockie got him twice last year, I think, the 2011 World Championships. So, I mean, it's going to be great just to kind of watch them go at each other. I mean, it's going to be awesome because here we have two of our own, you know, two American swimmers, two guys that we know pretty well, one that's obviously probably more of a favorite in Phelps. But at the same time, it's just this notion that,
Is he the favorite? Lockie beat him several times at the trials.
Lockie did. I'm saying a favorite as far as a fan favorite.
Okay.
Because I think Phelps is more of a household name than Lockie is still at this point. But, I mean, just the kind of the magnitude of that I think is cool. I mean, you know, anytime you have two Americans, too, it kind of takes the pressure off you as a fan. You know, I'm assuming, it, with the exception of you, who roots for Russia in the Olympics, I think that, I don't know, that kind of helps make things easier, less stressful, but at the same time more exciting because you have these two guys that you know and they're going at.
I found it funny that you use the word teammates because they're really the farthest thing from teammates because when you're teammates, you guys are striving together towards one goal. But ideally they're teammates because they're both on the U.S. team,
yeah,
and they want the U.S. to prosper and win the gold medal count and all that and all that.
At least swim in the relays together.
In the relays, yeah. But they're not teammates most of the time. If Phelps wins a gold and Lochte doesn't get anything, is he happy? Sure, maybe the U.S. wins the overall medal count, but it's not the same idea of togetherness and altruism, I don't feel like.
It's not like the beginning of that Will Ferrell NASCAR movie. What was
Talladega
that?
Talladega Nights.
It's not the beginning where Lockie and Phelps could be shake and bake and everyone could be okay with it.
You're not going to have, like, halfway through the race, you know, Lockie raises his fist and then Phelps does the same. You know, shake and bake. So, no, it's really, you guys are competitors. And I feel like even in the relays, there should be this kind of grievance between them. Like, they're two, like, forces coming together just because they need to, out of stubborn will.
Yeah.
Because it's for a greater good.
I thought it was funny that Sports Illustrated, you know, was looking at their preview issue and they talked about how Phelps went to this school, this inner city school that rebuilt their pool and everything and trying to get, you know, young kids into swimming. And so Phelps, you know, jumps in the water and he's like, you know, just buzzing through all this stuff, you know, and all the kids are oohing and aahing and stuff. And then, you know, one kid goes, oh, what's your split in like the 50 meter, something like that. And then like a little kid, and then he answers, and then he's like, what's Lockie's? And then, like, you know, so there's like this thing, you know, and you know, I'm sure he hates that. And I'm sure Lockie loves that too. I mean, it's kind of, he creating his own brand for himself too. And I think, and I do think too that, like I said before, you have to credit a hell of a job by the Olympics and kind of pumping this up, the American Olympic.
And yeah. I would actually say that it's probably more important for Olympic U.S. swimming that Lockie wins more than Phelps does.
Mm-hmm.
Because Phelps is done after the summer. Ryan Lochte's not. They need a face for that program going forward, right?
Sure.
I mean, if Phelps dominates again and wins as many medals you know, as he can, and Lochte kind of flames out a little bit, maybe there's a medal someplace due to whatever circumstance, or just gets beaten time and time again, what does that mean for him and the U.S. Olympic swimming program going forward? Because you don't have your face anymore. He's kind of the second fiddle. He's shown he's not the best, and I don't think it's good for them.
Yeah. I mean, in the Olympics, too, the one thing you can't do is you can't create a star overnight. You have to create a star at the Olympics when everyone is watching, and that's when you create a star. And even though, you know, we talked about the, like...
So, star over a Fortnite.
Correct.
See what I did there?
Nice.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you know, we talked about, you know, Jordan Burroughs and the U.S. wrestling team.
And you profiled them.
They did.
You can find that story on NJ.com.
If you want. But, you know, they did a really nice job of introducing us to him, but it's still going to take Jordan, you know, just crushing everybody in the Olympics, doing something really out of the ordinary to get our attention and then become a star. You know what I mean? And so that's what it is. I mean, the stars are born at the Olympics. You can't really manufacture them beforehand, even though they've tried and they've done a good job. So I think, yeah, like you said, Phelps has that power, but they really need to pass that baton at some point, too.
And I think that also is the same way in track. It's not with American runners. It's with two Jamaican sprinters in Usain Bolt and Johan Blake, you know, in the 100 and the 200 meters. And Usain Bolt obviously dominated everyone in a way we've never seen before in 2008 in Beijing. How he obliterated the field in the 100 meters, set a world record in 9.69. I think he spent the last, 20 meters dancing his way. and then he set, another world record, beating Michael Johnson's, what people thought was an unbeatable record in the 200 meters. And then he kind of fell off a little bit. He got hurt. Last year's world championships, he false started in the 100 meters. So he got was ejected from that. And his training partner, Johan Blake, comes away and comes around. And now he beats him twice at the Jamaican trials earlier this summer. And it's almost the same thing because Usain Bolt is the bigger name. He's the big money earner. But Blake is running better at this moment. And he could become the same type of star that Lochte is, over these next 2.5 weeks or so in London.
Well, here's the one question that I have, because I feel like Phelps and Bolt, you could kind of put in the same vein as they're so marketable. There's something about them that's exciting.
There's a charisma
and,
there.
Yeah, there's a charisma. There's a marketability. Bolt is hilarious in his commercials. Phelps
eats Bolt is a lot hilarious on the starting line.
Yeah, Bolt's funny on the starting line. You know, Phelps, he eats a lot of Subway, and we know that
and
about him.
A lot of pancakes as part of his 5,000-calorie-a-day diet.
Oh, yeah?
You know, that's he's for breakfast, a million pancakes.
Ugh.
It's crazy. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
What I would do to eat, a 20-pancake breakfast every day?
I was at the original pancake house in West Caldwell, and I just knew that it wasn't good for me when I was eating it. But imagine Phelps being like, I can do this, and then I'm going to be in amazing shape even after I eat this.
Well, isn't that what gets people to swim? If you know that if you can eat, a 15-pancake diet breakfast and be like, all right, well, I just got to swim it off. I'm good.
I think
that gets people in the pool.
Yeah, I'm going to put a pool in my apartment. Talk about marketing. But anyway.
I've seen your apartment. What is that? 10 meters?
Yeah. There's not even a bathtub.
Two strokes, you hit the end.
it's all about getting in shape. That's what it's all about. But anyway. So I think that, with Bolt and Blake and then with Phelps and Lochte, I think there's two very marketable people, two very marketable figures, and two people that are almost as good or just as good but are less marketable. So, I don't know. I still know where my fan rooting interest lies. I want to see Bolt crush people. I want to see Phelps crush people. And, that's what I... As an average American Olympic viewer, that's what I want to see.
I kind of want to see Blake pull it off. I'm not so sure about swimming. I'm not as in tune with that. But, with the track, I want to see Johan Blake pull off something miraculous. If, I think in Jamaica in the 200 meters, he caught up to Blake from behind, to Bolt from behind. We've never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
Now what if he does it under the lights of, in Olympic Stadium in London? He catches him in the 200 meters and he just runs him down? That would be great television. They both, if that happens, there's a good chance they could, break the record again. Because they're just both so fast on another level than everyone else, that would be enthralling.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think, me, at least personally, I like dominance. I like Tiger Woods, in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s. I like Jeff Gordon in that same time period in NASCAR, or Ken Griffey Jr., guys that were just untouchable for a period of time. And, I kind of want to stay in that as long as I can. So that's kind of why I want to see guys like Bolt just...
But don't you want to have, the 2016 Olympics kind of be like a Rocky IV moment for Usain Bolt?
No.
Where he gets beaten, and then he comes back after spending 4 years training in the Russian winter
again
in the mountains.
Again with you.
And just comes back, and, he beats Johan Blake in 2016. And where's the 2016 Olympics? I forget right now. Have they said it yet?
Newark.
It's in Newark.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Batman, now the Olympics. It's been a big few years for them.
Anyway, so swimming. We got the...
We got track.
We got the track. But, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, as sports fans, I think one of the most obvious watches here, is basketball. We love that. If you talk about dominance, you talk about headlines, you talk about names that we know, I feel like basketball is the best... one of the best sports at the Olympics to watch, just because A, you know, our country is so good at it, and B, we get to watch all these guys play together in a way that it matters. I mean, the All-Star games don't matter. We don't get to see players play like this
only
together.
Only the last 4 minutes, junkies actually, you know, non-junkies tune in.
Right. And so I think that that's probably my favorite part of the Olympics, my favorite sport, and I really don't see anybody challenging the U.S. I think, you know, we talked about Spain.
I don't agree there.
We talked about Spain, but at the same point, if you match up everybody one-on-one, I mean, I think the United States is going to be fine.
I mean, I think Spain and U.S. are clear-cut ahead of everyone else, and Spain with that front line of Pau Gasol, Marc Gasol, and Serge Ibaka. Yes, Serge Ibaka will be a Spanish player this summer. You know, I think they're the only ones who can challenge him, and they played yesterday, and it was close, relatively speaking, and who knows if both teams were playing to their full abilities. They don't really want to give everything away. But I think it'll be a good game. I remember in 2008, it was close going into the final minutes, and Spain's going to be hurting without Ricky Rubio, a point guard. But it's not inconceivable to me that the U.S. loses. They're really short in the front court, and that's where Spain has their biggest advantage. And I could see this going into the final minutes, you know, one or two possession game.
Match up Spain's best three players with who will likely be marking them on defense.
No, I get that.
But just
okay.
Humor me.
Okay. So if they decide to go with the big front court, you have Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, and Pau Gasol being guarded by Tyson Chandler, LeBron James, and Kevin Durant.
I mean, come on.
I understand.
If this is a regular NBA game, are we even having this discussion?
But you know, things are different there. I don't know. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying I could see it happening.
I know that we like to...
I would say it's still a better argument than who wins this year's Olympic team or the 92 Dream Team. That
one's
innate.
That's such a ridiculous argument.
I think the interesting part is we see basketball in the Olympics as a star-studded event, but this could be the last one of its kind. In 2016, we could have it go back to non-NBA players, or it could go soccer style where you have to be 23 and under. At that point, you know, no LeBron, no Kobe, no Durant, none of those guys. You know, no players of that caliber will be on an Olympic team for the foreseeable future then.
I think that would be just so ridiculous for the Olympics.
I think it would be cool.
I think it would be one of the most absurd things that they could do because what's driving viewership? It's things that we want to see and people that we want to see. And, you know, okay, there are a ton of really talented, you know, and I think that we know our under-23s in the States so much better because, you know, most of them play for Kentucky and, you know, so we'll know,
know
who they are.
The Kentucky team.
Yeah. I mean, we'll know who they are, but at the same point, why would you take away? Like, I think it's fun to see, you know, guys like,
I do too. You know,
Tony Parker playing for his home country, Pau Gasol playing for his home country. I think that's great. And I think that taking that away would be a huge mistake because it gives every team like a little bit more name recognition. I mean, could you imagine in 2006, I think, was that Yao Ming's last Olympics?
2006 was not an Olympic year.
Or
2008.
I'm sorry, yeah. 2008, was that Yao Ming's last year on the
Chinese Olympic
team? I mean, could you imagine that team without Yao Ming?
Yeah, it'd be Wang Zhiji and Yu Jinlian.
Were they both under
that?
23 at that point?
Oh, under 23.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, who would want to watch that?
Hey, look, I from a junkie point of view, I'd love to see it. Like, just pure basketball junkie, I would love to see a team of, you know, under 23 guys playing together, seeing what the next wave of potential NBA stars is. Then again, you can't beat what we're going to see this summer, what we're going to see in a few weeks.
Exactly. There's nothing better. And so I think it appeals maybe to the junkie in all of us, but at the same point, why would you take away a proven formula? I mean, the guys love it. I mean, the players love it. They get to see all these elaborate, wonderful places, take their families, everything's paid for. They get to hang out with each other. And, I mean, you know, and
Instagram photos on Twitter.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
I think Darren Williams Instagrams 48 photos a day of the U.S. Olympic team eating, riding Segways, like, you know.
He's just happy to be on a winning team again. It's been a while for him.
It's very true.
So those are the three marquee events, and I just want to ask you real quick. You mentioned guys like Jordan Burroughs, and maybe you want to name him again, but name me the one event or the one athlete that we should be paying attention to. in the upcoming weeks that's kind of going under the radar?
Well, I guess selfishly, you know, you could say there's a couple good ones from the New Jersey perspective that, you know, our columnist Steve Pelletti did a really nice job with a Colin Jones story that ran in
today's paper.
Today's paper, Wednesday's which is paper. Wednesday's paper.
And you can find it on NJ.com.
Correct. And, you know, so we have guys like Colin Jones, a great story, great backstory. And then you also have people like, you know, we have a lot of other New Jersey related athletes. We have someone from, I forget the town, but in world class trampolining.
That's a sport?
Yeah.
I missed that one.
The Gluckstein.
Is that really?
Gluckstein.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Dave D wrote a column about them. About
couple
a
weeks
month or
ago.
So ago,
yeah. So we have a New Jersey native in trampoline. We have fencer from Avenel, Dagmar Wozniak, who a story on her appeared in Wednesday's paper as well.
By you?
By me.
You can check it on NJ.com. Avenel spelled with two E's.
And yeah, so I mean, a lot of like fun, like you know, trampolining's cool. You know, just to kind of see. What might happen there. Fencing, I mean, one of the cool things about fencing that I actually learned is that a lot of times the higher seeds, I mean, it's not really a sport that's dominated by the higher seeds. It's really kind of like it's just riding a hot hand all throughout the tournament. Wozniak earned, I think, she's an alternate in the 2008 games by, she was a 64th seed in a world championship tournament and won it. So, I mean, you know, just that can happen at any point, which I think is kind of cool. And just to kind of have a face there as well.
Let me give you two things I'm looking for.
Okay. One, the Blade Runner. He's not from Jersey.
Oscar Pistorius from South Africa.
He's
not running the relays.
He is not from New Jersey.
No.
But.
I like how you just called him the Blade Runner. It reminded me of how Christopher Nolan, the Batman director, has seen Blade Runner 200 times. the two things that are interesting to me, both.
Blade Runner's not interesting to you?
I've never seen it.
No. Christopher Pistorius. He's not
he's interesting to me. More so for not how well he'll run, but just the idea.
There's an ethics debate behind that.
It's a very big one. No, what's interesting to me is long distance, two long distance running events, and as a failed distance runner, I know this kind of a thing. Galen Rupp, 5K runner. You know what? Here's the thing. The U.S. has never been good at distance running. If they can get a distance runner who's dominant, who wins a gold medal, when the sprints are failing them, it would be huge. Because right now, maybe the biggest overall plot line is who's going to win the medal count, the U.S. or China. And there's a lot on the line there because China almost nipped them in 2008. Projections show them neck and neck now. There's so many political things at work there if China were to beat the U.S. I mean, they've had such a huge buildup. It's really not overstating the meaning of that.
I'm going with Lithuania.
You're going with Dark Horse?
Gold medal count.
What are the odds? Okay, can you get good odds on that?
If you get 10,000-1 odds on anything, you take it. And that's what I got on the Lithuanian Olympic team.
So we're going to end our Olympic conversation with Connor's betting tips. Make sure to always pay the vig, guys. and move on to a little bit more of a somber subject.
Yeah.
Monday, the NCAA dropped the hammer on Penn State, giving them harsh, crippling penalties that some, maybe overreacting, said were almost akin to the death penalty, but they fined them $60 million.
Some people said it was worse than the death penalty.
Some people did. I tend not to listen to those people. But, you know, they fined them $60 million, four-year bowl ban, scholarship reductions for the foreseeable future from, you know, almost 20 a year, and a few other things. You know, vacated the wins from 1998 to 2011, so Joe Paterno no longer the all-time winningest major college coach. And I think the bigger question here isn't was this too tough, but was this even necessary? And you and I have kind of discussed this between ourselves in the past few weeks, but it's still conflicting to me that the NCAA should have acted here.
I think you can make an argument either way. I think who's going to come in, and I think the problem with all of this was that they're allowed a NCAA football program to be a front for everything that was going on behind this. It made people act unreasonably. It made you know, I'm talking about Paterno and the athletic department here, you know, trying to protect this record and this reputation and everything. And it made people act irrationally, not the way that they would normally act. And then the rest of it, you know, this program is a front for some really, I mean, some awful, awful things that happened. Yes, and so who else is going to come in and put their foot down and say, this is a culture issue, and now we are the NCAA, and now we are also in the culture issue business? Because, I mean, they had no choice. I mean, I really don't think they had a choice.
Let me give you my opinion on this and tell me what you think. I think that the NCAA acted here because they want to maintain relevance. They didn't have, you know, this was kind of in their nexus, but it wasn't a bullseye for them. And so they wanted to act here because they needed to keep their relevance as a regulating body when everyone else is also coming down on Penn State, and they knew Penn State would take it because they have no bargaining power here. And I think that some of the penalties were unnecessary. Like, what's the point of the scholarship cuts? If anything shows to me, nothing further proves to me that the NCAA thinks of student athletes as just athletes than taking away educational opportunities for 20 athletes per year. Why take away those scholarships? Why not allow them to have 85 scholarships but dress only 65 guys a game? That, to me, shows that, you know, you've heard a lot about how the student-athlete debate is whether they're actually student-athletes. This shows to me that they're just athletes, because that's the only perspective you take in cutting scholarships. It does no one any good. I heard Jay Billis made a great analogy. He said, if you're going to penalize a hospital, are you going to take away their hospital beds and their ability to treat people? Is that how you penalize a hospital, by taking away their ability to do their job and help the sick?
Well, I think the argument there is that Penn State lost their right to.
But what is there? But it's not Penn State getting hurt. It's 20 kids who could have gotten an educational opportunity at a very good school, and there will be a trickle down effect of some sorts. And you can try to negate it by saying, it's just 20 kids. But that's still 20 kids who get an educational opportunity.
What's to say, though, that they won't go elsewhere?
But there will be a trickle-down effect. There's only a limited number of scholarships in total. Somewhere along the line, 20 students are going to lose their ability to go to school with a full ride, one that they maybe would not be able to afford themselves. What is the benefit there? You're hurting people that don't need to be hurt. You're hurting future student-athletes who are going to be a decade removed from everything.
I understand the point there, and I think that is just an unfortunate kind of side effect to this whole thing. I mean,
You know, Mark Emmert talked about not wanting to make it extremely punitive. Isn't this where you try to?
Well, I don't know why he talked about
where you minimize all the side effects.
I don't know why you're talking about not making it extremely punitive. I think it should have been extremely punitive. You know,
I'm not sure that the NCAA is the right ones to act here.
And I think that, and to kind of follow up on that, I think that you have to, because this is. It's sort of like a landmark ruling, you know, something like that the Supreme Court would do to set precedent, you know what I mean? And they say that if another major college football program out there, and we know that there are bad things happening at big basketball programs and big football programs across the country.
But those,
nothing this.
I was
going to
say,
this,
those
nothing
bad
like
things
this,
are
nothing
relative.
Like this. Yeah, nothing like this.
If they're even bad things, depending on which way you take the NCAA's
nothing
rules.
Nothing like this. But they're saying, listen, if you use this football program as anything other than what it's supposed to be used for, and, you know, it's understandable there is money to be made here, there is, you know, all this and that and the other thing, but if you do that, this is what's going to happen. And yeah, it's sad, and yeah, it's terrible, and yeah, I mean, they're going to lose some scholarships.
Isn't this a mall cop doing the job of a U.S. attorney? Like, the NCAA, their job is to enforce NCAA rules, these self-important rules that are really created within their own construct
does
to
Penn
serve
State,
themselves.
Does Penn State compete in the NCAA?
It does. Okay. No, here's the argument for it, is that, you know, basically it's a trade association punishing an insubordinate member. But because these are real issues, these are not ticky-tack, agent paid a player or someone got free tattoos or something like that.
Well,
shouldn't you leave that to someone who's more competent?
The U.S. attorney is more than welcome to come down on this, too.
He most likely, you hear that, you know, the FBI is investigating this. Leave it to someone who is competent.
So, but can they take away scholarships? Can they limit?
But what's the point of taking away scholarships here? How does that punish the crime that has been committed?
It's deflating. What Penn State was this, you know, you think of it as this grand, you know, this grand castle of, you know, and now what it's doing is it took away all the bricks and it fell over. And now you cannot hide anything anymore. It's deflating the program to the point where stuff like this isn't possible anymore. And is it a bad thing? Yeah, I mean, and
were things like that not going to be possible, you know, based on the deterrent effects you see of a vice president and athletic director now facing perjury charges and maybe the president doing the same thing? Wouldn't that have served the same deterrent effect and more so than losing scholarships and vacating wins?
Because you need to take away what they had that was able to build themselves into this and what was able, what allowed them to become a front for all of this stuff is the wins. It was the bowls, it was the legacy, it was the brand name, it was all that stuff. You have to take that away. You have to make football something there where it's just football again, and it's not something that you build an entire community around, which is what they did.
I get that football was like the opiate of the masses there, but I feel like you're asking the drug dealer to punish them instead of the cops.
What?
You heard me.
Explain yourself.
I don't feel like it's the right. The NCAA is as much involved in deifying sports as any of its member schools.
It's true.
And now that you're asking them to come down hard, this is all optics for them. They want to seem important here, so they want to say. I heard that Mark Emmert was talking about the penalties before the free report even came down. This isn't them just trying to rush to bring something out there to make themselves look like they're important here.
There's no doubt.
You know what? This offended my morals.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt that that is part of what happened. There's no doubt.
So what point does it serve then?
The point is what I've been saying. I mean, you need to – the NCAA can do what, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office cannot do, which is undercut the program.
And I mean, the Clery Act can strip them of financial aid. I'd say that undercuts the school more than it does.
So why are you punishing the entire school then? If you're talking about, you know, undercutting financial aid, and you're talking about feeling bad for the 15 or 20 kids that aren't going to get scholarships there, theoretically, down the road.
What I'm saying is that will affect the school. That will undercut this whole notion of football is bigger than everything else at Penn State, more than cutting scholarships and vacating wins, which is one of the most ridiculous penalties you can serve onto someone to try to rewrite history. Here it's kind of relevant because that's what one of Joe Paterno's big things is. But, I mean, just in general, to take away quote-unquote wins as if a national championship never happened for USC or something like that,
it's
preposterous. Like, you're not going to scrub
it
history.
It is, but like you said, in this case,
in
it's
this
where
case,
it hurts.
I understand
it's where
relevancy.
It hurts. Yeah,
I understand that.
Right where it
but
hurts.
But that's just an overall critique of the NCAA. So, some of its penalties are just – it's just ridiculous. To vacate wins in every other scenario –
in every other scenario, though, I think this is right.
I don't know. You know me. I'm not a big fan of the NCAA's dealings. I find them to be, what's the word? I guess unnecessary, superfluous.
Personally, I think they should just take that $60 million and make sure all those people get help. You know.
Well, they're giving it into an endowment for programs that are for victims of child abuse.
Yeah, which is the right thing. I mean,
yeah, no, it's obviously the right way to
spend it. And I think it should be way more than that. I think it should be any sort of free funds that the university has. I mean, these people need
help.
Well,
now this is like asking a jury to, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when someone sues for money, for a lump sum of money, you're like, well, how much is getting into a car accident worth?
Yeah.
I mean, the university is still going to have to deal with the civil suits that come from all of this, which, you know, after the free report have a basis that's so much larger than we thought even, you know, a month ago. And who knows what that's going to number into.
My hope is that what we can do for now is, you know, so much of, and I think we'll leave it at this and you can get a last word in too on this, is that I hope what we've learned from all this is twofold. A, as media, I hope that we've learned that the most important thing isn't taking a morality, like a stand, you know, and saying, well, you know, how could they do this, you know, and, you know, putting yourself in a position against what happened. We all know it's horrible. And I think the most important thing is, and hyping up this statue, making sure the statue must come down and all this stuff. I think the most important thing is getting to the bottom of this and making sure that, because to me, you know, finding out that the money was going to a charity to help these people, that's the most important thing. Yeah. And I think that I hope that we can learn to kind of cut through the fray when it comes to stuff like this as media. And B, you know, I hope that, I guess it's sort of the same point in general. You know, I hope that that can kind of be the focus moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope that what we get out of this is that, you know, sports are just sports.
Mm-hmm.
Football coaches are just football coaches. There's no reason to deify them at any level for any number of achievements they may have, mm-hmm. because it's all in the vacuum. I guess we'll leave it at that, and we'll move on to our final topic of this podcast.
We should say, too, that if anybody, you know, if you're listening to the podcast, I know you can play it, you can stream it right on NJ.com. Yeah. We have a comment section below that we check regularly, you know, and we'll leave our emails and our Twitters on there, too. So, I mean, definitely. If there's something we miss out, you know, definitely feel free, and we can bring that up in the conversation, you know, the next time that we do one of these.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you either in the comment section or our emails. Or on Twitter, you're at Connor T. Or I'm Mike_Vorknov, and we'd love to engage in a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I guess just lastly, closing this out, moving on to baseball a little bit, it's a tale of two cities. Sorry, I had to go cliche there.
Ooh.
I know. I apologize. Anyway, I saw Batman, so many Dickens references. Whatever. The Mets and the Yankees go in two very different ways right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Mets losers of 11 of 12, 11 of their last 12, 10 of 11 since the All-Star break. The Yankees running a hot streak up until last night when they lost to the Mariners, and then they lost Alex Rodriguez for 6 to 8 weeks, kind of taking some of the fun away from their acquisition of Ichiro Suzuki a few days ago. And I mean, really, I guess just starting with the Mets before we go to the Yankees. Connor, you were there last night. You spent the weekend there in Citi Field. What's going on?
I haven't seen the clubhouse this down, and you know I think that having you know Andy, our Mets reporter, kind of speak to this would you know he would know more than I do. I mean I've probably covered about 20 I think home games this year, but you know I've never seen them that down before. You know it's a team that David Wright said it last night. I mean when we pitch we can't hit, and when we hit we can't pitch. And at what point I guess does that become evident? And the other thing is, you know, Sandy Alderson came out over the weekend and said the next 7 to 10 days will determine whether buyers and sellers, buyers or sell, whether or not we're buyers at the trade deadline. They're clearly not. I mean, this is not a team that's going to make a move at this point because the wild card seems out of reach. The division seems out of reach, theoretically. I mean, unless they go on one heck of a tear and then you could do something in August. But I really think it's a team that kind of realized what they were, and now it's going to be really, really hard for them to come back from that. And even going forward, I mean, there's not a lot to be positive about right now.
I'm just wondering, I know you mentioned how Sandy said the next 7 to 10 days will determine if we're buyers or sellers, but you look at a team like the Marlins that are in much worse shape, not in much worse shape than the Mets. They've already traded Anibal Sanchez, Omar Infante, and Hanley Ramirez. So that's half your infield and a prime starting pitcher away. They're kind of giving up on this year and looking towards the future. Wouldn't that be the more prudent move if you were the Mets?
Absolutely. I mean, you have, and I don't know, I mean, this is all, you know, chaos theory, but, you know, what is R.A. Dickey worth? You know, I mean, he's a 37-year-old knuckleball pitcher, theoretically has three good years left in him. What is he worth at the trade deadline? You know,
it's worth exploring, right?
Exactly. And I mean, you know, if we're talking about building for the future, and, you know, Sandy's talking about 2013, 2014, you know, that's the target date, then something kind of has to happen now. I mean, you need to bring in some good younger players that are going to be able to contribute right away. And you look at what they have on the roster right now, and they're saying, you know, we're pushing towards next year. But what's to say that maybe Ike Davis is a 225, 230 hitter, you know? Maybe Lucas Duda is a 230 hitter, and maybe they cap out at 80 RBIs this season. Maybe they're not 100 RBI guys. We don't know that. Maybe Ruben Tejada is just a average shortstop, and maybe, you know, maybe Jordani Valdespin can only hit
pinch hit home runs. He can only hit pinch hit home runs.
Maybe Matt Harvey isn't electric. You know, maybe Wheeler's not electric. Maybe they're good. You know, maybe they're good back end of the rotation guys, but maybe they're not front And, I mean, they're obviously not Strasburg-type pitchers. I mean, or else, you know, they would have been selected much higher, you know, and thought of much, much better. But what if this is the first half of the season, you know, second-place kind of scrappy team is the best we're going to get? Because that division is not getting any worse.
No.
And, I mean, and the Nationals are primed for a big-time run for the next couple of years.
I guess we're both in agreement here that if you're the Mets, in the most cliche way possible, you sell, you don't buy. No matter how the next 7 days go. 7 to 10 to, you know, leading up to the final days before the All-Star break. This is where you see how much each one of your assets is worth and can bring you back, and you look to 2013, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point, you're going to have to accumulate top-end talent that can match. You know, obviously the Nationals have so much top-end talent. The Braves have a lot of top-end talent. The Marlins, even after trading Hanley Ramirez and Anibal Sanchez away, they get Jacob Turner back from the Tigers, who's a stud prospect. You have Giancarlo Stanton. You have Emil Bonifacio. I mean, so they still have a lot of top-end talent there, and I feel like the Mets just don't have that in the decks for them.
And, you know, I think what they could do, and I mean, it's probably dangerous, and it's at the same time, but I mean, they have a lot of, you know, young names that we know, or at least Mets fans who follow the team are familiar with, guys like Familia and Wheeler and, you know, Harvey, guys like that. You know, at some point, just bring them all in. I mean, let them throw for...
Just spend September seeing what you got?
Spend September just showing everyone this is what we mean.
Wouldn't that be a show of good faith to Mets fans, too?
Absolutely.
Because you need that, too, with, I mean, especially since economics are such a big worry for the organization, to keep the fan base interested in coming to games, buying tickets, and buying season ticket plans next year.
And how, I mean, you know, let's just say this, they continue not at as bad of a pace. I think they will eventually win some games and sort of at least get a, you know, get their feet back under them. But let's say in September they're 8 or 9 games out of the wild card, 8 or 9 games out of the division. I mean, are we really going to want to see, I don't know, I mean, Miguel Batista spot start on a Saturday afternoon? I mean, you know, just build it up, you know? I mean, make a big deal out of it. Say, you know, we're going to have Familia close for a week, or, you know, we're going to have Familia up for, you know, a couple games. We're going to let him close. We're just going to, you know, this is... Because, I mean, how, I guess, damaging could that be to a top prospect? How harmful could that possibly be?
Yeah, and the Mets are 47-50 right now as of Wednesday afternoon. They've got a game today. They're 10.5 games out of first place in the division, 6 games back of the wild card. And the Marlins, 2 games back of them, already calling it quits for the season. We'll see what the Mets do. And on the other side, in the Bronx, the Yankees doing a whole lot better. 58-39, lead the division by 7 games. So a playoff spot seems in store for them.
The Mets, by the way, I know this will have nothing to do with
our podcast. Breaking news?
With our podcast listeners listening tomorrow, but this could obviously change. But it is the... we're going into the top of the 9th, and they are down 5-2.
I thought you were going to tell me it's J-Wow Day tomorrow at the stadium.
It was Snooki Day.
It was Snooki Day.
Earlier.
Weirdest thing I have to tell you, her boyfriend, Gianni Laval, was there, swinging a baseball bat. 8th grade teammates, he and I were.
Really?
Yeah, so, you know.
What position did you play?
I played third base.
Do they have baseball in Russia? Anyway, Yankees.
I'll give you a courtesy laugh there.
Thank you.
All right. Although he's definitely not Russian. You can tell that much,
at least. Yeah, he's from Seaside.
No.
Looks like, well,
lovely
looks like.
East Hanover.
Right.
Where we have about 4 reality stars.
I don't know. You have, like, this very South Beach look to you right now. If you popped a little gel in your hair right now, you'd be right down with the Jenkinsons crowd just fist bumping, and that would be right up your alleyway.
Well, you know, sometimes I'll drive home after, like, a long work day. Like on a Friday, Saturday night, getting out of the office, you have like when the station's playing the dance music, you know, like
you're the at remixes? A club
or something. Yeah. I'll pump my fist.
Okay.
Yeah, pumping and driving.
You just don't do that in Scranton. But anyway, we're talking about the Yankees to kind of close things out. Obviously, the loss of Alex Rodriguez for a little while hurts. I'm curious to see if that power core, you know, the 3-4-5. That they always rotate around based on matchups. I'm curious to see if it's not more productive. I mean, obviously, A-Rod's numbers have been in decline. He's hit well lately. But, you know, like I said, I'm curious.
Do you adjust the lineup now? Do you put Ichiro lead off, you put Derek Jeter second and move Granderson somewhere in there so you can alternate lefty-righty, lefty-righty.
Yeah.
Is that what you do?
Yeah.
And I know Ichiro came here under the thought that he'd be an eighth-place hitter or something like that, but isn't that what the situation dictates?
Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, and even if you're talking about the Yankees are a team, Ichiro batted third for a time in Seattle.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
Especially with that right field porch in Yankee Stadium.
I mean, that's a thought, too. I mean, you know, and the Yankees always talked about hitting with runners in scoring position. You know, they've accepted the fact that they're a home run team. They're a team that's just going to crush baseballs, and that's what they're built on, and, you know, that's what the park's built for and everything like that. But to get Ichiro up with runners in scoring position is just as valuable. Although, I do like, you know, putting him at the top of the lineup like the original idea was with Brett Gardner at one and then Derek Jeter at two, because that way you get a guy that's going to get on, swipe a base, that
kind of thing. Although the big problem for Ichiro this year has been getting on base.
Right.
He's got like a 290 OBP.
So, I mean, that entire team, though, nobody can hit at Safeco.
Yeah.
I mean, that entire team is having a hard time hitting at Safeco. But
I like the idea of this Ichiro, Derek Jeter 1-2. You're not going to see a lot of pitches because they're not extremely patient guys. But, you know, you can get them on base. You can get them stealing bases. And it gives their lineup a different dimension than if Granderson is hitting number two, where you start the power trail there, as opposed to, you know, Cano hitting third, Teixeira hitting fourth, and Granderson hitting fifth, something like that. That's more run scoring opportunities.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's nothing not to like about that trade, the acquisition.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything that you bad that you can say about it. They got him for absolutely nothing.
Yeah, just giving away what? Like the rights to Ricky Ledet and
Farquhar.
And Shane Spencer September 1998.
Farquhar. They gave away Farquhar.
And DJ Mitchell.
Yeah. Lord Farquhar.
Yeah, I guess the conversation about the Yankees is a lot shorter. I mean, Alex Rodriguez is out 6 to 8 weeks. That is what it is. You just wait. You see when he comes back.
They have a platoon. Like, if
well, you play at third base now. Chavez. What do you do? You play, but he can't play every day.
And then you platoon him with Knicks.
The guy needs to stretch for like 14 hours a day just to pinch hit.
Yeah, you do Chavez and Knicks in a platoon, and Knicks has been okay. You know, he's been an average.
Can you bring back Cody Ransom?
Oh, now you're talking.
I think he's a former Scranton Yankees star, right?
Sure is. Cody Ransom.
You spent the summer tailing Cody Ransom.
I did. I covered the team in 2008 as an intern. And
have you ever thought about writing a book?
Yes.
Your days covering the Scranton Wispar Yankees?
Yeah.
I would buy it. At least an ebook.
I wouldn't.
Like $2.99?
No chance I would buy it.
Here's another thing terrible for the comments. Tell us if you would buy Connor's book about the Scranton Yankees.
But Cody Ransom set the franchise record, I think, the Scranton Yankees franchise home run record. And I asked him how he felt about it, and he said, absolutely terrible. He said, it's awful that I've been down here for long enough to do that.
Is that like the former Major League Baseball star who, like, can't get a deal in MLB and has to go to Japan and sets, like, the all-time home run record there?
You do what you gotta do.
You do mixed emotions.
You do what you gotta do. Everybody's a star somewhere.
That's actually the tale of your book. We're going to call it. So we're going to end it there. Look for Connor's book, You Do What You Gotta Do, a story of the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Yankees. It's going to do it for us. Thanks for listening, everybody. As always, make sure to check out the Star Ledger and our coverage online at NJ.com. Buy the Star Ledger. Subscribe to the Star Ledger. Check us out on Twitter. He's at Connor Tior. I'm at Mike_Vorkunov. Can't wait to see you guys next time for the next Star Ledger podcast.
Adios.